History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. We're always educated, we're always entertained, and without fail, we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. It is Father's Day weekend, and for those of you fortunate enough to still have your dad around, I'm sure you're going to make some new memories. Over the years, one of the most frequent comments I've received from listeners comes from men and women who tell me their fathers never talked about their war experiences, but that hearing other men share here on Hometown Heroes gives them a better idea of what their dads might have gone through. I was blessed to have an amazing father who invested intentionally in my heart and my soul, and his father, a decorated doctor in World War II, was the inspiration for my first starting to record veteran stories over 20 years ago. We've heard from a whole lot of dads here through the years, and also a lot of memories of their dads. But I want to start this Father's Day episode with something that happened in Washington, D.C. this week. Retired Marine Corps Major James Capers was awarded the Medal of Honor for his Special Forces exploits. Retired Army Major Nicholas Dockery also had his award upgraded to our nation's highest honor for his heroics in Afghanistan. But for three brothers who witnessed those overdue recognitions, another moment is something they're going to be reflecting on this Father's Day weekend. Let's hear the story from the Commander-in-Chief.
Next, we honor another legend of the United States Marines who is sadly no longer with us, Colonel John W. Ripley. In the spring of 1972, the North Vietnamese prepared their Easter offensive, the largest ground invasion since the Korean War. It was a big, big invasion. Over 30,000 North Vietnamese soldiers and 200 tanks and lots of other equipment, high level, planned to penetrate deep into South Vietnam and collapse the embattled republic. The only thing standing in their way was a bridge across the Chu Viet River and the extraordinary courage of then-Captain John Ripley. Everybody knew he had that. As North Vietnamese forces surged to the North River bank, it became clear that the assault could only be stopped by destroying the bridge. Vietnamese Army engineers had stockpiled over 500 pounds of explosives that needed to be personally placed under the bridge. As the only soldier with sufficient demolition experience, John reached for the first load of explosives. Everyone said, "Don't do it, John, don't do it." He grabbed the steel girders above his head and hand over hand, he climbed, dangling beneath the bridge and over the rushing water with a lot of very angry people watching him. Completely exposed to withering enemy gunfire, John completed not one, not two, but five such trips. He was a strong guy, a very strong guy. At one point, John remembers a tank round blasting into the bridge and knocking him temporarily unconscious. For five straight hours, he hauled explosives, placed charges, and ran a primer cord to each one of them. He later recalled reciting a simple prayer, "Jesus, Mary, get me there, just get me there." When John detonated the explosives, the bridge collapsed into the river, crushing the advance and saved the hope of a free Vietnam for Easter morning. For his heroic deeds, John Ripley was given the Navy Cross, and today we posthumously award him the highest of all awards, the Congressional Medal of Honor. And we're grateful to be joined by his sons, Tom, John, and Steve, grandson, Stephen, Lewis, and Francis, and his beautiful daughter-in-law, Alexandra. And so I want to thank you all for being here, and congratulations. You have extremely good genetics. So congratulations. Please. As we approach the 250th anniversary of our founding, we remember that we owe everything to heroes like those we celebrate today. Men who went willingly to the darkest and most dangerous corners on earth to defeat evil so we could live free. That's exactly what happened. These are great men, great people. We thank you, and we will never, ever forget you.
Well, that part of it's up to us, isn't it? The Medal of Honor story of John Ripley, pretty unforgettable. And 18 years after his passing, his children have another special reason to remember him this Father's Day. For the rest of our time on the radio today, we're going to hear highlights from a story that came to mind for me in light of Father's Day for multiple reasons. The gentleman we're going to listen to for the rest of the hour is one of our last remaining World War II prisoners of war. One of the first Americans to ever shoot down an enemy jet. Yes, he's a father, but his family's contributions to World War II included his own father. And before becoming a decorated fighter pilot and concluding his career with the title of colonel, Joe Peter Burrs had actually aspired to a different vocation that would have had him being called father.
I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is, of course, 1924. The Depression hit in, of course, 29, and my dad moved to Wisconsin for more opportunities for work and stuff. So, and then I grew up normal, went to Catholic school, Holy Assumption, in Westallis, Wisconsin, and we're really sort of rough little kids.
That's a lot of boys to keep in mind.
I don't even like to talk about it because, you know, people would be shocked after what we did at 6 and 7 and 8 years old. But it was a fun time. We had a loving family and a lot of good support. My oldest brother was 10 years older than me, and my youngest brother was 5 years younger than me, so I was right in the middle.
How'd you all get along?
Oh, fine, yeah, no problems. We all went our own way, you know. So it was a good time. I had a real vocation. When I was in fourth grade, I had to write a book report, and I picked out a book report on Father Damien, who was a missionary with the lepers on Malachi in out of Hawaii. And I was really impressed by the story, and so I wrote the book report on it. And I've been to Catholic school, and of that time, it was all nuns, and I just became the apple of all their eyes. You know, I couldn't do anything wrong after that. And I did a lot. We used to skip school for four-alarm fires and stuff like that, you know. We'd hear the fire engines, and we'd see, oh, that's a four-alarm. Hop on our bikes and go tear it after it. But that's the sort of an environment was in. And I was really the top server and the pastor, Monsignor Burbach. He knew, he felt that I had the vocation, so he supported me. And so when I finished eighth grade, I entered the seminary at St. Nazian's, Wisconsin, and started there. So I was going along really anxious, working towards getting my, of course, at that time it was 12 years, 4 years high school, 4 years college, and 4 years of philosophy, theology and philosophy. So it was a long, long way to go.
It's a lot of Latin.
Oh, yeah, a lot of Latin, Greek. My first year, I was taking 9 hard subjects, and the languages, I was taking Latin and German and, of course, English. And the next year, Greek would have been thrown in.
Well, it's funny. So many of the pilots that I talked to, they had some kind of moment where they caught that aviation bug and their eyes were taken to a higher plane. But it sounds like you had to bring yours down from an even higher plane to end up with aviation, huh?
Yeah. Well, I remember just like it was yesterday. It was a Sunday, and we had just finished Mass and breakfast. And I was going to the gym, and I entered the gym, and we had a basement where we had the pool tables. I loved to play pool. And I was about halfway down the stairwell to the gym, and there was a loudspeaker right at the corner of the middle of the stairway and the radio. And I went on. They said Pearl Harbor was bombed. And then I knew at that moment that I'd be leaving the seminary and joining the services and so on.
Is that because of your father's legacy of service?
Yeah. My brother had joined the Army in around 1936, I think. And my other brother, Paul, he graduated from high school at 16. So before he started college, he wanted to get some experience. So he joined sort of like they had a Navy reserve. And he joined it. And unfortunately, the way things developed, I think it was about 1940 that he joined it, and the way things developed, they kept increasing their contract that they had with him, and by the time he was 18, they had integrated him into the regular Navy. Sort of the sidetrack. He was really ticked because he was smarter than all of us, and there were three of us that were all getting, of his brothers getting commissions, you know. Mm-hmm. And he was a master machinist mate. So, and he was killed during World War II. He was on a sub chaser, and it was torpedoed off of North Carolina on the 5th of August of 1943. He was on the USS Plymouth.
There's so much going on here that I want to understand. And maybe the first part is your father's legacy of service, because you've got a picture on your wall here of the five of you brothers who served in World War II. You had another brother serve in Korea, but your father's also on that picture, and it says he served in World War II, but he was in the military a long time before World War II.
Yeah, 1909.
Wow.
And before that, he was in Germany, of course, and he was in the German cavalry out of Munster.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Did you hear many of his stories?
No, that's how I got into research, because he'd tell us stuff here and there, and you know, little hints of this and that of what he did. We didn't know if it was a lot of BS or if it really happened. So after I retired, I started researching. Well, the problem is that there were two great fires at the center, one in 57 and then another one. But he was killed in an auto accident in 1954. He was still in. He was in Germany in 1954.
Man.
I'm rambling around. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, there's so much to cover here. And I'm interested in, I mean, of course, a lot has been written, and you've written about some of your own exploits in World War II, but I'm just fascinated by your family's commitment here. So, and you said you knew immediately, but here, you know, you've had this vocation, you're mm-hmm. called to the priesthood, and that you're close to doing that.
Yeah.
What was it that compelled you that now I'm going to have to go serve my country?
I could say it's in my genes or something.
Yeah.
That's the only, growing up, and I was having been my father, I was always sort of inclined to military things, you know, the movies and all that sort of stuff, and the knights in shining armor and all that, and the old movies, Dawn Patrol and Wings and things like that. They were all really interesting and exciting. And of course, I didn't know that I was going to join the Air Force, even when I just knew I was going to serve. I didn't know how. I was only 17. So when I left the seminary, I was 17, and I tried to join the Navy, but I failed the eye test. So I had heard that eating carrots would
I've heard that
so
a lot.
I was eating bushels of carrots until I turned 18. And 18, you had to, the Air Corps, you had to be 18. But you had to take a competitive exam. So I'm selected. I'm okay to take the exam. So I'm standing. We're in some place in Milwaukee, a big hall, and we're all standing around, probably about 50 of us. And we're all going to be in there taking exams, talking to people, and having our 4-year college graduates, and some are 2-year college graduates, and some are, you know, both 99.9% graduated from high school. Well, I hadn't finished high school. I had more than enough credits to graduate from a regular high school, but I still hadn't finished. I hadn't gotten my diploma. So we went in and took the exam, and you had about a 50% success rate, and I was one that passed the exam. So I was accepted on the 30th of November, 1942. 25th of November, I took the test, and that was my 18th birthday. And on the 30th, I enlisted as an aviation cadet.
Had you ever been in a plane before?
No, never even. I don't even. I saw one. I've never been into an airport. I don't, except up in the air, mm-hmm. flying over or something. So that's it.
And maybe you can touch on briefly the contributions of your whole family. You mentioned your brother, no greater price anyone can pay than that. But I'm sure that you're proud of what your father and your other brothers did too.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about what they did during the war?
Well, my oldest brother, George, like I said, he had enlisted in 36. It was, you know, the Depression times. So he was a sergeant when the war started. They immediately gave him a commission when the war started. So he was a lieutenant. First, he served down in the Florida area, the Coast Artillery. And then he was transferred to Iceland and spent, I think it was sort of a training thing in Iceland before going over to Europe. because he ended up in Europe, and then he was in the invasion of southern France, you know, which was several weeks after the main invasion. So he fought through that and then was in the army of occupation. And then until 1950, when the Korean War started, and his whole unit was immediately transferred to Korea. So he was with the 8th Cavalry in Korea, and he won the Silver Star. He had two Purple Hearts, and I think he got one of them in World War II, and then another one in Korea. He, through a very heroic action, he received the Silver Star, and then several days after that, he was killed on the 2nd or 3rd of November of 1950, when the Chinese came across and did a counterattack, and he was killed. There were 800 men in his unit, and I think only 200 survived, something like that. So I gave my, you know, they've been searching for, you know, because he just,
they never found his body.
I never found his body. So back about 20 years ago, I gave my the DNA, and if they ever do locate it, I guess it was picking up for a while. I don't know what the status is now. But they have a briefing, an update briefing every year, the Army does, as to what the status of the recovery is.
Yeah, and you know as well as anywhere how many Americans are still over there that have never been located.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
From the Korean War.
Ancillary to that is that my youngest brother, who did not serve in World War II, he, and in Korea, he was 17. He joined the paratroopers, and he made two combat jumps in Korea, in combat. And he was in the area my brother was, and they were able to meet and spend a couple of days together, about a week or 2 weeks before my brother, other brother was killed, my brother George.
I'm just thinking about your family. I mean, yeah. Gold Star family twice over.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a heavy price for a family to pay.
Another thing associated with the family, my mother, is when I was bailing out in Germany, the thing I was thinking of was, oh, my mom's going to get a telegram saying I'm killed or missing or something or other, and I'm okay, Bob.
Because she's already lost one son by that point.
Yeah, by that time she had lost one.
The contributions of the Peter Burrs family to our armed forces is hard to top. It's time for our first break, but still to come on this special Father's Day edition of Hometown Heroes, the day Joe shot down one of Germany's most prolific aces was the day he too would be shot down, and the twists and turns his journey took are hard to fathom. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Father's Day edition of the program. Many of the veterans we've met here over the years were recommended by someone who called them dad. And if you still have your dad, I trust you're going to make it special. Joe Peter Burrs was one of six brothers to serve in our armed forces in addition to their father. Two of those brothers became Gold Star heroes. In 1943, while Joe was training to become a fighter pilot, he received word that his brother Paul had gone down with his ship, sunk by a German U-boat along the Atlantic coast.
That was a very traumatic for me, because we were 2 years apart, and we were, you know, not only brothers, but best friends, and everything together, and we really loved each other. Anyway, I got the word, and I went to my room, and I just bawled all day and all night. And then the next day, I said, I got to pull myself together. I pulled myself together and got on the thing. And I think that sort of affected my, it would made me not as, oh, how do you?
It affected your outlook or your
motivation? You know, I don't get, I mean, people were dying left and right around me, and it did not affect me. It did, you know, I didn't, I guess I isolated myself from really deep friendships where I would be hurt if I, you know, missed them. I had three, four of my really good friends killed in World War II. You know, I felt bad and felt sorry and all that sort of stuff, but I didn't have the deep emotional strain that I had with my brother.
Sounds like maybe you forced yourself to almost insulate from it a little bit.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for, insulate, yeah.
I understand this still isn't easy to talk about, and I'm not trying to be dramatic, but you say you went home to comfort your mom. Mm-hmm. Could you get a sense for how that affected her?
Oh, yes, yeah. It was really deep, you know. And of course, you know, she had other... Her husband was gone. My dad was already fighting in the Pacific. In his 50s, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was in the invasion of the Philippines with MacArthur. And so, you know, it was a very traumatic, and, you know, they wouldn't accept it for years after that. They still thought he was missing, you know, and this sort of thing. It was, you know, he was working in the engine room when there were torpedoes. Yeah, what, you know, you're not going to survive that.
So you get that news before you ever head overseas. And
oh, yeah. Well before I finished training. Yeah.
Did it make you question whether you wanted to continue?
No.
What do you think was that drove you? What was your motivation?
Oh, I know. I think it was primarily the sense of when I was very young, 16, 17, I knew what I was willing to die for. I was willing to die for my God, my family, and my country. And, you know, there was no ifs, ands, or, you know, that was it. Mm-hmm. And, I felt the evil that was, you know, it sort of goes along with actually the religious aspects of my life, too, because it was pure evil that was going on. So I had real motivation. Maybe it increased my motivation.
I could see that. So you've got some time in the steerman, some time in the Volte vibrator. And was flying something that grabbed you immediately? Did you feel that rush or that, you know, this is what I was made to do?
Oh, yeah. With the steerman, it was just because that was aerobatic and I was good at aerobatics. I could take that thing, put it on a point, spin it and see 3.5 turns and pop it right out of it.
What do you mean could? I bet you still can.
I would try it.
I know some guys who go around with a two-seat steerman, and they take guys like you up anytime you want to go. So.
And then the thing, I was in C. I graduated from primary in C, and we went to basic with the BT-13. We finished that. There's no room in the – so then we're put back about that. So I accumulated probably close to 100 hours in the BT. The normal thing was 65. And then I went to Napier Field in Dothan, Alabama for advance with the T-6. Mm-hmm. So I flew that, and I was on the aerobatic team there. Finished that with, you know, no problem. And then 15th of April, 1944, I was commissioned a second lieutenant, fighter pilot, and I was 19 years old.
What are the odds of that? Not too many guys can tell that story. Do you remember the first time you climbed into a P-51?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had to go to the P-40 first.
The old Warhawk.
Yeah. So after we graduated, we went to Fort Myers, Florida, where we flew the P-40 in. There must have been 15 or 20, they called them RTUs, replacement training units, in Florida. All of them to my knowledge, they either had P-51s or P-47s. And then we had, there was only one, we had the P-40.
You guys had the leftovers, huh?
Oh, yeah. But it was, the P-40 was like a big steerman as far as I was concerned. You know, it handled really, really nice. And we had jumped the 51s. And if they wanted a dogfight with us, we could beat them in a dogfight.
Really?
We were more maneuverable, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the speed advantage and other technical advances were in the 51 that we didn't have in the B-40. And I flew the A-24, which is a SBD, and we used it for instrument training. And I got about 40 hours in it, two-seater, and you get in the back and you put the cover over the canopy and you'd fly instruments. Mm-hmm. That's how you got your instrument training. Anyway, I finished that, and I'll had one ride, a flight in a L-5.
Oh, nice and light.
Yeah, I was on duty. I was duty officer. I got called from the flight line and said, hey, we got a sergeant on the emergency leave. You need to fly him up to Orlando. And I said, okay. I came down and I said, where's the, I'm looking around, where's the bird? They said, well, you're good in this. I said, what's that? L-5. I was expecting an A-24.
A little bit different.
And so I said, well, how the hell do you fly this? I said, and they said, well, I'll show you how to start it. They showed me how to start it. So the sergeant Seth jumped in the back and went tearing up to Orlando, from Fort Myers to Orlando, and got to Orlando, and it's a B-24 base, and all the, you know, traffic's going in and out, and I call for landing, and they clear me, and so I'm going in, and like a good fighter pilot, you know, I land on the first part of the runway, going, and I think the tower starts screaming at me, get the hell out, get down that runway. So I took off and flew it and landed on the last turn off, and then flew back, no incident. But I got about, I think it was 5-6 hours in the L-5.
I guess if you expected an A-24, you were looking for the dive brakes on the L-5, huh?
Right, yeah.
Well, I guess the better question, Joe, is what haven't you flown? Probably not much.
Oh, well, yeah, no, I was very limited, you know, 51 and the A-24, P-40. But later, you know, but when I was more in the administrative field, I flew C-47s, B-25s, had some time in the B-24, the A-3, and several others. And then, of course, the F-80A and the F-80B, and then the T-33. Mm-hmm. Never did get into the supersonic stuff, but I always wanted to get a fly the 86, but just the opportunity never came around. So.
Well, you did fly quite a bit, over 400 combat hours, is that what you said, in the P-51?
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
What was that like the first time you revved those engines up?
Well, the story here now, I'm finished, I've got about 140 hours on the P-40, so we're shipped overseas, and go over on the Ile-de-France, and if not convoyed, it could, you know, it could, with its own speed, it had enough speed to outrun the submarines. So anyway, we get over there about the 2nd of November and land in Scotland, and I go down to Peterborough, King's Cliff, RAF station, and that's where we were stationed, the 20th Fighter Group, 55th Fighter Squadron. I was put into the 55th Squadron. They had the 77th and the 79th. Were the three squadrons. And I was put in the 55th, and the 20th was just transitioning. They had just started in July, transitioning from the P-38 into the P-51. And they were having lots of troubles. You know, the no torque to the torque of the 51.
Sure.
In fact, the day we came in, we were on the perimeter. We were in a 2.5-ton truck and all set in the back, coming around the perimeter road over to the administrative area. We had to stop because a flight was squadron was coming back in from a combat mission. And we're sitting there watching them land, and because none of us, we were all P-40 guys, and there were seven or eight of us, and watching them land, and the 51 comes in, and he hits the runway and bounces, and we're all watching to see what he's going to do. And we heard him start the throttle up, and we said, no. He just threw that full throttle, and he just went right in. So Ooh. That was our welcome to the 20th Fighter Group.
Well, you know what not to do now.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, you know, you do with the torque of the 51. The torque of the P-40 was not quite as bad, but it was severe. You'd do the same thing in a P-40 if you'd thrown the engine, the power to it during that sort of situation. But anyway, we checked out the 51B and flew the C most of the training and got a D. The B had a Spitfire canopy, a modified canopy, a bubble canopy on it, and then went to the D and got, I think, 16-something hours in the P-51 that started flying combat.
Did it take you a while to get a feel?
Oh, no. What no it, from the P-54, 51 was just, going from a... there was not that... There was lots of, improvements and stuff like that as far as speed and handling and this sort of thing. So it was... We just... read the manual and hopped in.
What did you like about the Mustang?
The altitude that we could get, the rate of climb, and just overall performance. It was, nothing in particular. Well, the thing is, it grows on you. And by the time I was halfway through, I just felt like it was part of my body. I was thinking about going left, and I go left. I'm thinking about going right, just like driving a stick shift after you don't even think of what you're doing. You're just doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was able to get that feeling between myself and the aircraft, that we were one piece of machinery.
Well, and that's a good thing, because you were going to be in some very difficult positions, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Did you have an expectation before you got into combat of what you thought it was going to be like?
No, just a lot of fun. You had to give a 19-year-old with a 2,000 horsepower engine and 650 caliber machine guns and say, hey, there's the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I never was afraid or concerned or anything like that. Through all the various things that happened during the 5 months I was in combat, maybe sometimes, I can't even say I was apprehensive, but it was just, you were going to get killed. It's the other guy that's going to get killed. You aren't, you're going to live forever at 19, 20 years old. That's the attitude you have. And you're out there to do the job. And I was nicknamed the Strafing Kid because I just loved to strafe, and I did a really good job at strafing. So it was an exciting experience and a fulfilling one, too.
Well, and I want to hear as much as you're willing to share it. It just strikes me what you shared early on about what endeared you to the nuns at your Catholic school was your admiration for Father Damien. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he's famous for caring for the lepers and mm-hmm. having no regard for his own personal safety. And mm-hmm. I think he probably had the same approach, right?
Yeah,
leprosy's not going to get me.
I never thought of that, but that probably is true.
And you had those Messerschmitts, whether they're prop-driven or later jet-driven, they're not going to get me.
Yeah, yeah.
And most of the time they didn't.
Yeah, oh, yeah. The time they, well, no, they did not. They never did get me because I shot down my ground fire.
There you go. Well, what was it like to encounter the Luftwaffe in the air over
Europe? Okay, my first encounter, it was my 11th mission sometime in January, 13th of January, something like that. But there were about 1,200 B-17s. It's escorted by about 900 fighters. And we were going to targets in the Magdeburg, Berlin area. And we were probably 20 minutes out of bomb drop time for the bombers. And we were hit by a couple hundred of 109s. Their tactic was that the 109s would come through, hit the bombers and run, hoping to draw the fighter escort off, which in many units they did. But with our we were really told, you stay with the bombers. Your job is to protect the bombers, not to go chase an aircraft,
Mm-hmm.
And that was the attitude we had. And then we were hit by another couple hundred of 190s, 109s first, and then 190s. And then they'd stay and we'd mix it up. And there were dogfights all the way from 35,000 feet down to the deck, from Berlin back to Magdeburg. And there were engines falling, wings falling, parachutes in the air. And I was more concerned about hitting debris and stuff that I was being hit by another aircraft. But anyway, I saw 190 coming towards me. So I pulled into front and did a check-in with them. We were doing head-on, and I was firing, and I could see this cannon blinking around his nose, and I kept firing. I saw a couple of hits in his wing, and I passed about 50 feet underneath him. My flight leader, he was behind the 190, but he couldn't fire because he'd be afraid to get the hell out of there. So as soon as I passed under him, then he blew him, and we got him there. But we got 19 and a half kills that day in the group. But, you know, the bombers got slaughtered. And at that time, I thought, you know, I just wish I could be as brave as they are, because they would go to the targets humming along at 150, 160 knots and being hit by flak that you could, and then being slaughtered by the bombing, but they went to the target. I never saw anything like where the bombers would deter from their course, and I just hoped I could be as brave as they were.
Sounds like you had to be, and I'm sure a lot of people are noticing how matter-of-factly you describe some of this, and I know you've told your story a few times, but what you just described is not what a typical 19 or 20-year-old is dealing with, where you're flying a plane at high speed with another aircraft shooting at you and flying directly at you at the same time, and one false move can end your life.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't sound like you felt too much pressure.
No. No. I was going to get that guy, but...
And in April 1945, he got that guy, a prolific German ace named Walter Schuch, who he would actually get to meet decades later. Joe was in a P-51, Schuch was in an ME-262 jet, but that would also be a day that nearly claimed Joe's life. Joe Peter Burrs just published the fifth edition of his autobiography. Maybe it'd be a good Father's Day gift for a dad in your life. Our Father's Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Father's Day weekend. We're listening to the memories of one of America's oldest dads, Joe Peter Burrs, who will turn 102 come November. Back on April 10th, 1945, he was a 20-year-old P-51 pilot about to experience perhaps the most eventful day of his life.
The bombers dropped their load, and simultaneously we were hit by a swarm of ME-262s. Well, I latched onto one of them. I saw he blew up one B-17, and I'd, you know, been rolled over to start down. He's down to around 25,000. So I got throttles wide open, and I'm coming in, and he's pulled into a second B-17. And just as I was pulling into a six, the second B-17 blows, and I start firing, and I get hits in his left wing and engine. I see a little smoke and fire. So he rolls over to a slow right turn and starts down to the deck. And I'm chasing him, and I'm losing my speed advantage, of course, because he's down, his head balls to the wall, and I'm even, you know, but he's still got the advantage. And we get down to about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and there's a deck of clouds, undercast, and he pulls into it. And he tells me later, after years, 60 years later, that when he went into that cloud, he makes a left turn to get rid of me if I've chased him into the clouds. And during that left turn, his engine disintegrated, and he started his bailout procedure. But anyway, unbeknownst to me, I see him go in. I tell him I'm not going to go look for him in the clouds. So I pull off, and I look over to the left, and I see him airfield just loaded with aircraft, you know, all types, and just spread out, said, "Come and get me." And so I start over there. I go get down to the deck, balls to the wall, hoping to get some surprise. So I get there, start strafing. Oh, well, my flight leader was behind me during this time, and he was following me the whole way. We get down, it was Dick Tracy, Captain Tracy. We get into the airfield, and we make a couple passes. We each got a couple of the first pass on the ground, and then on the third pass, Tracy gets hit. He's down right on the deck. He gets hit, and I see him get hit, and I see him bail out at about 300 feet, and he lands in a river right next to the airfield. So I continue around. So anyway, I made many too many passes. I made probably four or five passes, and then my last pass, and I got hit a couple times in the wing, but didn't affect the aircraft. But it's come around to the last pass. I see this ME-200. FW-200, the Condor. So I'm coming in on him, and I feel a thud. And so I'm firing, and it blows up, and I'm pulling off, and I feel another thud. And I get oil over the windscreen, and so I'm pulling up. I get up to 10,000 feet and much altitude. And I try manipulating. There was some kind of a procedure. You manipulate the throttles, mix your prop control and that sort of stuff, and you get better performance or some performance on the engine. So I'm deciding whether or not to go to the east or the west. The Russians were closer, and they were to the east. And we were briefed that the front lines, the Allied front lines, were in the Magdeburg area. And Magdeburg's about 80 or 90 miles from where I am. So I decided to go to Magdeburg. I'm losing altitude all along, and I'm down to about 1,000 feet. I'm over Berg, which is a suburb of Magdeburg. It's just outside of Magdeburg. Anyway, I'm down to about 1,000 feet, and so I think, hell, I'm going to have to bail out. So I unstrap everything and get ready to, and I catch out of the side, my right side. I see this FW-190 coming in at me at my 3 o'clock positions. My aircraft is burning by now. And so I pull into him. He fires his rockets. It misses. And by that time, I'm down to 500 feet. I'm too low to bail out. I got to belly this thing in. So I'm looking, please, I can't belly it in. I've unstrapped. I'll kill myself. So, of course, this is all milliseconds, of course, going on in your head and stuff. And it's training that is, you just do this stuff automatically. You know, new circumstances, other circumstances, things are popping through your mind, and you know what to do once you learn the circumstance. So anyway, I have to go out of the left side because the right side is burning. I mean, the fire is coming out of the right side of the engine. So I pull out, I get out in the wing and let myself go. And as published, I hit my knee on the horizontal stabilizer, pull the ripcord. My chute opens and I swing once and hit the ground hard. So at that time, I think, well, I better find out what's going on and where I am. I get up and I look around and, oh, for nothing, not a tree for, oh, 300-400 yards. And there's a group of 10 or 12 civilians coming at me. And so I'm looking at them, I think, I'm going to really get it. And about the same time, when they get to about 50 yards from me, a Luftwaffe sergeant comes tearing up on a motorcycle, stops and stops the civilians from taking me. He said, no, you know, he pulls out his Luger and he's going to protect me, which is good because there were quite a few that were killed by civilians on that mission who were bailed out from that mission from the bombers. And anyway, about the same time, a bunch of about four or five elderly gentlemen, probably in their 30s, 35, came out. And one was probably in his 50s or 60s. And he was the chief of police, wearing a leather hat. And he had a left arm. His left hand was a black leather glove, you know, probably lost his hand during World War One, but it was right out of one of Eric Stroheim's movies, you know. Typical. That's what I was thinking at the time. And anyway, they take us into town. The sergeant says, okay, you can question them for a while. We go into probably the Burgermeister, the town hall or whatever they called it. And people are starting to gather outside. It's getting a little noisy. But anyway, we get in and they're searching my clothes and everything. They see, find a rosary that I always carried in my flight suit. They say, oh, I'm told later from the sergeant, they're saying, how could this Catholic be killing innocent men and women and children and stuff like that? You know, and the chief of police, he pulls out his Luger and actually puts it to my head. He said he wanted to shoot me on the spot. And the sergeant pulled out his Luger and said, we're leaving. I'm going back to the base. So things quieted down. He took me out, put me on the motorcycle. By that time, the cows crowd was getting a bad crowd out there. So he takes me. He was stationed at a major airfield at the Berg. And that's where he goes. And then they put me in the local jail at the airfield. And I'm questioned by the Casavo for, you know, no torture or anything like that. But it's just questioning for about 2 days. Then they bring me down to the train station and put me on a boxcar. I was waiting for the train. And them to put me on the boxcar. And one of the railroad guys, he comes up to me. He says, hey, you want a schnapps? I don't know what schnapps is. I take a swig of that, and wow.
Hello.
Those are, just little things that it's hard to remember all the details around it, but I remember him giving me a schnapps. So I get on the train, and it's probably a couple hours. We get off, and I'm at Stalag 11, which is a POW camps, mainly occupied by British. But they had already evacuated the camp, and there was only about 100 Tommies left. And so we were put on a forced march. The next day, we started marching.
Lucky you.
off back to Berlin, where it all started, you know. And so we have 6 or 7 days of the march, and of course, it was just people, just refugees going from the east and the west and just pandemonium. Motorcycles running up and down the road. The military vehicles were trying to get by and this sort of stuff too. And they were just trying to get the traffic moving, and it's just hopeless. And then to top it all off, a couple of times we were strafed by our own fighters, you know. And we survived that. I got to Stalag 3 at Luchtenwalde, which was a mostly Russian and some Scandinavian POWs. There were, I think, about 4 or 5 of us American. Tracy was there. He had ended up immediately after the strafing was over. They sent him to Berlin, to Tempelhof, and then down to Luchtenwalde. So he was there. And two of the sergeants that were on B-17s that were shot down that we were escorting were there. And Lieutenant Stewart, who was strafing another airfield, was from our unit, was there. So I get there, and they already were planning escaping. One of the sergeants could speak fluent Russian, so they said, okay, we're going to get out of here and get in contact with the Russians. So I said, hey, I'll go along. And the escape was basically, the security was practically non-existent. There were a few guards around. It was just a matter of going under the fence at night, which we did. And we went down walked about 5 miles along the road towards Berlin. And here comes a tank unit rolling down the road. The sergeant, we were hiding in the ditch, and the sergeant jumps out, says some Russian stuff to him, and waves us out, and we come out, and they throw me a gun and hop on the tank, and off we are to fight the Battle of Jitterbug and Wittenberg on the Elbe. So in Jitterbug, I'm out on the patrol with the sergeant, Russian sergeant. We come to a complex, civilian complex, housing complex, and really nice apartments and this sort of thing. So he's in there, and he is really mad. And he tells us to get aside, get out of the way. And he gets in the middle of the room with a burp gun. And he just stands with that room and destroys every, they had nice radios, nice furniture. And he just stood in the center of the room laughing like hell and just spraying everything. And I'll never forget that. I thought, this guy's a little nuts. You know?
It's the Russian rage at destroying German property,
yeah.
Basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want people to catch that because your story is pretty unique. There are not too many guys who can tell a story like this. So you're shot down. If that Luftwaffe officer doesn't come over, you're probably dead right there at the hands of civilians. Mm-hmm. He saves your life. You're a prisoner. You end up on a forced march. You survive that. The next POW camp, you escape, which the odds were overall in Europe in POW camps, not good for trying to escape, but you do that. And then, since you run into a Russian tank outfit, all of a sudden you're part of the Red Army.
Yeah.
You're fighting the same enemy, but for a different country.
Right.
You can't make this stuff up.
I don't.
So now you're actually an infantryman in the Red Army.
Right. And then from Jitterbug, we go all up to Wittenberg, and we have a few skirmishes on the way. Not major, but dead bodies, German bodies, soldiers all over the place as you're going by. That, you know, for a guy that's a fly, you know, we don't get close to the war. And I really increased my appreciation for what the ground troops do, because it was, you know, it's a horrible situation. You know, you just can't even compare. It's there's no comparison at all between the things you go through in the air and the things you go through on the ground. It is just, I mean, the leadership and the bravery and everything that's involved in fighting on the ground is so much surpasses what's in the air.
Well, and I guess the other question I have to ask you, because you told us the circumstances of your bailout, and even that, your odds of surviving a bailout from that low altitude the way you did are not strong. But I have to imagine that you weren't in the best of physical shape after that.
No, I had sprained my legs, and I had some burns on my leg and my arms. But it was, you know, 20 years old, I hope you could take that. We were at Wittenberg, and our U.S. Army patrol comes across, and the group of us that escaped, I forgot to mention, someplace after we passed Jitterbug, I noticed I was, you know, we were separated throughout the thing, the column, and I lost contact with all the other Americans. I was the only one left.
And you don't speak Russian.
And I don't speak, you know, I could speak a little German, and we could do, and the Russian lieutenant could speak a little English and a little German too. So we were able to get some, but I couldn't get any really solid idea of what's went on. When we get to Wittenberg and the patrol comes across, they're sort of hiding me. The Russians are sort of keeping me out of sight. They're not, you know, hey, here's your buddies coming in. They were keeping me out of sight. And fortunately, the team leader, the patrol leader, saw this flight suit. He knew it was an American flight suit, so he started talking to the lieutenant, you know, who's that back there? And they had some discussion back and forth, and reluctantly, he released me to the patrol. But anyway, well after the war, over 60 years after the war, I find out from Sergeant Lewis, who we came in contact with each other. He was one of the escapees, the sergeants. We came in contact through a mutual German researcher. Oh, back in, it was, I think, about 1998 or 9 or something like that. And he told me, he said, that a American general came over and met the Russians, and they took all of those guys back with him. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell? Why was I left behind? Didn't they tell him that there was another guy in it? Or was there some kind of a, I have no idea. And I'm the only guy left now, so it's impossible. But it's a fog of war that I'll never understand.
So according to that version, all the Americans had been
reclaimed
from the Soviet unit.
Yeah.
And it sounded like you were saying the Soviet commander was reluctant to let you go.
Yeah.
What do you think would have happened to you if you had to stay with those guys?
I think I was just a pawn for, you know, at this time all the political stuff was going, Potsdam conferences, you know, all this was going on. Patton wanted to continue the war to go to Russia. So there was, and I think maybe they just, I have no idea, absolutely no idea. And I didn't really give a crap back then when I was really just having a lot of fun. No, I was taking care of myself.
And he still is, as he heads toward birthday number 102. No doubt Joe Peter Burrs will have a special Father's Day, and I suppose there's quite a bit he would have missed out on if he had stuck with his plan to become the kind of father that wears a Roman collar and officiates Mass. You can link to his book at hometownheroesradio.com, and keep your ears open for a chance to meet Joe soon. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. Make sure you take care of the dads in your life this weekend. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.